Thank you very much, Sid, and certainly a pleasure to be back here again. And, we've had two very fascinating talks already this morning, so I hope that we'll be able to continue in that mode. So what I thought I would talk about today is just a little bit about metastasis. What I'm going to do is do really a little bit of a broad brush, but hoping to really come at it a little bit in terms of where we might think about modeling, and just show you a little bit of data from an old paper about the concept of kind of modeling metastasis in patients and how we might go forward with that idea. So just to initially to kind of introduce you to the concept of metastasis then. Metastasis, as I'm sure you all know, then represent really the spread of the cancer from the primary tumor to different sites, and there are two primary types of metastasis that we can think about. Metastasis which spread via the lymphatic vessels to local lymph nodes, or metastasis that spread via the systemic circulation to distant organs. Mostly that will mean that they will pass through the heart and lungs, heart anyway, and then into the lungs. Hope I'm not going to lose this microphone. And then onto other organs. And if they also may spread via the portal vein directly into the liver if tumors happen to be in the intestinal system. So here we see then this concept that we have these. Oh, sorry, I'm going too fast here. We've got blood-borne metastasis, which then, as I say, represent this part of the system. And most cells which actually escape into the circulation probably arrest in the first pass organ that they see, which would either be the liver if tumors are in the intestinal system, or in the lungs if they're in other parts of the body. But you can detect circulating tumor cells in the body. So there are cells which will pass through these first pass organs. Sorry, this is not working for me. Is that okay? Nope. Maybe I'll just hold this if that works okay. And then, as I said, the other system then is the concept that cells can escape into the lymph node system to form lymph node metastasis, and from there they can then escape into the blood circulating system, and lead on to distant metastasis. Now, what's been shown over a longish period of time, in fact, is that one can predict in many cases where metastasis will occur for different types of tumors. So this is actually data from an autopsy of breast cancer patients, and really showing that most metastasis in breast cancer patients occur in the lungs, or in the liver, or in the bone. And then at late times you see metastasis occurring in other parts of the body, but the primary sites are these sites, and different tissues will actually have different patterns. Lung and liver, as I said, are very common, but other types of tumors will have patterns which appear to be relatively specific to those tumors. So we have this concept then that there may be sort of preferential sites for metastasis for different types of tumors. Now, the reason, of course, that metastasis is a major issue for us is that most cancer deaths actually result from metastasis, and mostly this is blood-borne metastasis. And what we usually assume clinically, in fact, is that most such metastases are actually seeded prior to diagnosis, but they remain undetected at diagnosis. If we know that they're there at diagnosis, then we can treat them. But many of these metastases are actually undetected at mitosis, at diagnosis. And so what we might like to try and do is actually predict the likelihood that such micrometastases actually exist in the patient, even though we can't detect them with our usual imaging techniques. And there's a lot of work going on at the moment to really develop improved prognostic tests, and John talked to you a little bit about that concept in leukemia, but genes expression signatures are also being widely used in solid tumors to to really try and predict for the likelihood that patients will actually have micrometastatic disease, disease that we can't detect in any other way. And this decision is very important for patients actually with early stage disease, because the question at issue is, should we do something, adjuvant prophylactic chemotherapy in breast cancer patients in order to try and prevent those metastases from growing and causing problems for the patient? And going along those lines, he said, well, what level of treatment might actually be required for this to be effective? And one of the issues that is developing over the particularly over the last 10 or so years is the concept that if we have solitary metastases which develop in patients after the treatment, successful treatment of the primary, can we deal with them? And increasingly, where surgery and radiosurgery, in fact, are being used to do that. But one of the questions here again is, how do we identify the appropriate patients for this type of treatment? So what do we know about metastasis? This is animal data, and this is the issue of how of metastasis actually developing in as a function of the primary size of the primary. So here is data in it. This is the Lewis lung tumor. This is a very rapidly growing animal tumor model, and what has been done here is that the tumor cells were injected intramuscularly into the animal, and that as a function of time after that injection, this is days along here. That leg at the site where the injection was done was irradiated with a large dose of radiation, and then what we did was we tracked to see when we could see metastasis developing in the lungs of the mice. This is the site that this particular tumor actually forms metastasis. And what you see is that the longer you wait, the more likely you are to see metastasis, and that's consistent then with the idea that what's happening here is that the larger, as the tumor grows, it's more likely to throw off metastasis. And in this particular experiment here, the size of these tumors, when you start to see this process occurring around about 50 to 100 millimeters, this is a very metastatic tumor model that this tumor is. Here's another data set from a rat mammary tumor. And here we see that these metastases are actually occurring don't start to really occur to a larger size. And here we're looking at lymph node metastases in this particular case. But again, the same kind of concept. The tumor has grown up to 8 to 10 millimeters, and then it's excised in this case, not the same kind of concept, as a function of time after that point. And we look at metastases, and again, we see that the longer we wait, the larger the primary tumor gets, the more likely we are to see metastasis in these animals, and so this gives us a concept that might not be too difficult to really accept, that as the tumor grows larger, it's more likely to metastasize. And this is similar data from patients. This is the same data plotted in two different ways actually. This is the same kind of concept that we're showing over here. Where now we're looking at human breast cancer, and we're looking at distant metastasis from breast cancers, and we see now, as this is tumor volume now is on a log scale here, so there's a big range of size over which we see the development of metastasis in patients, and some patients are developing metastasis when the tumors are relatively small. This is a cubic centimeter here, whereas we're almost up to 100 cubic centimeters over here. So what this is telling us is that there's a wide range of times over which metastasis will develop in different patients. Some tumors are much more likely to develop metastasis earlier than others. And this data, this is the same data actually plotted on a probability plot scale to show that actually fits actually quite nicely to a probability relationship, as we can see from the sigmoid shape of this curve. And this is two different time windows. This actually shows the time windows over which this data was gathered. It's pretty much impossible to gather this kind of data nowadays because of the treatment strategies which are currently being used. But it illustrates the point very nicely that size helps us to predict when metastasis may occur, but it's by no means a very good predictor, because some tumors don't metastasize until they get to very large sizes. There's a general agreement that the larger the tumor is, the more likely it is to metastasize. And what's very important to recognize here is that if you actually, most of the data we have about cells being shed from tumors, and I'll show you that data a little bit in a minute, says that even at these very small sizes, tumors are actually shedding cells into the circulation. But those cells are just not forming metastasis. It's only as you get to these larger sizes, and presumably larger numbers of cells being circulated and shed into the circulation, that you actually see metastasis formed. And this is another data set. This is from data from the Princess Margaret, actually just looking at cervix cancer. And what we're looking at here is failure rate for different. This is for local failure, and then this is lymph node metastasis in the periotic nodes, and then this is distant metastasis at distant sites from the tumor. And there's two different groups of patients here. This is a historical data set. Here they were treated with radiation only, and then more recently the treatment of strategy of choice is radiation plus cisplatin. But you can see that even with the combination of chemotherapy here, we still see the development of distant metastasis, and this goes on over quite a long time period. This is years of after the primary treatment, and this is the only site of failure in these patients. So what we're seeing here is patients that had their primary cured but developed distant metastasis over a four-year period after treatment. And the same is true here. Disappointingly, perhaps you might argue that the cisplatin didn't actually impact very much on that time window, and we'll come back to that concept in a minute. So, as I was saying to you, what's been shown from a large number of studies is that there's a large number of tumor cells which are shed into the circulation from primary tumors. And work that's been done often with surgery, actually looking at the number of cells exiting veins from tumor sites. This was done initially in tumors which were in the kidney, which have only essentially one major exiting vein. You can actually track the number of tumor cells which are being shed. And for big tumors, these are quite large tumors, we're seeing very large numbers of tumor cells being shed into the circulation. But many of these patients develop very few metastases, indicating that the efficiency of metastasis formation is actually very low. And you can see almost exactly the same effect in animal models using transplanted tumors. And as I said earlier, you can detect tumor cells in the circulation in many patients, but that's a very low number, and I'll show you that in a minute. So one of the questions here which still remains unclear is, why is metastasis so inefficient? It could be that there's just a very low probability that cells which are in an environment which they're not used to — we've talked a lot about the importance of the environment that cells are actually in — that just really can't establish growth, and we'll come back to that issue in a minute as well. There's also, we've heard a lot from John this morning about the concept that tumors may actually contain only a small proportion of cells which really have the capability of actually regrowing a tumor. So you may be shedding a large number of cells, but maybe most of those cells are really just end cells which no longer have the capacity to form a tumor. So we're seeing large numbers, but what proportion of those really are stem cells? That's an important question. And then more recently, there has been the demonstration that in animal models, there appears to be the development of what's called a metastatic niche, somewhat similar to the concept that John mentioned with the concept of a stem cell niche, where maybe the primary tumor is in some way able to condition other organs to be more likely to accept the cells which are being thrown off from that tumor and kind of find their way to that niche. And it was kind of interesting when we were listening to the previous talk that one of the genes which is potentially thought to play a role in the development of that niche is actually lysyl oxidase, which may say something about the importance of mechanical differences, and we'll come back to that just in a little bit in a minute too. So what's the process then? This is the kind of a general concept of the process of metastasis. We've got the primary tumor, the cells are shed into the circulation. They go through the circulation at some point in the first pass organ. The cells will be arrested in the capillaries of that organ, because by and large tumor cells are quite large. And once you get into the small capillaries, they've got to kind of stretch out. Some of them manage to get through, but most of them will be arrested. Some of them may be able to survive in that environment. Many of them will not. They'll probably die off. Ultimately, if they do and they actually escape from the vasculature into the interstitial space of that organ, they may then initiate growth, and ultimately then they will of course have to regenerate blood vessels by angiogenesis to generate a functional metastasis. And so there are many kind of limiting steps, if you like, in the metastatic process in order to be able for a cell to be able to do this. And years ago, Fiddler developed this concept that there was a whole series of steps, and if the cell has to be able to actually pass through all of these steps in order to be able to form a metastasis. But we'll come back to that issue in a little bit again, as I said. So where are the limiting steps? Well, work done by the group in London, work done in Anne Chambers' lab and Rob McDonald, I think. They're looking really at how cells grow to form metastasis when they escape from the vasculature. So they're looking at this case at cells in the liver parenchyma, actually by microscopy, intravital microscopy. And so what they were able to show was that when they injected cells into the circulation, most of the cells actually arrested in the liver parenchyma. That's what we said that we expected, because that's the first capillary bed that they hit in this particular case. Many of them were able to get out of the vessels into the liver. Now, liver may be a special case here, because many of the liver endothelial linings tend to be fenestrated, so it may be easier for cells to get out of the liver circulation than happens in other organs. Those cells stuck around in the liver for quite a long time, but they didn't necessarily grow very much. They slowly started to die off. Only a very small fraction of them were actually able to divide in the liver and form micrometastases. And many of those micrometastases, another couple of orders of magnitude down, ever grew to form macrometastases. So the process, even though the cell has got to the new organ, the process of actually forming a metastasis appears to be very, very difficult, because of the fact that those cells are in an environment, probably because of the fact that those cells are in an environment that does not suit their normal growth characteristics. So the difficulties of being able to establish that growth are very high. And as I said, probably this experiment actually underestimates the problem associated with survival in the liver circulation and actually getting out of that circulation. And that's illustrated really by this slide, the other animal model system, where we're looking now at cells which have been injected so that they'll be arrested in the lung, not in the liver. And what is happening to those cells? Well, two different experiments here, but both basically showing the same thing. If you look at the fraction of those tumor cells which undergo apoptosis after injection, you see that that's a very high fraction. Many of those cells are undergoing apoptosis and dying off, and they never effectively get out of the circulation. Or if they do, they die off as they do. And here in this experiment, we're looking not just at apoptosis, but all forms of cell death essentially. And in this experiment, what we've actually done is we've injected the cells into the animal, and then and they're arrested in the lung. And then, as a function of time, after they were injected, the lung is removed, and we actually recover the tumor cells, and we ask, how many cells can we recover? And what you can see is that depends on whether they're treated with hypoxia here, but that's probably irrelevant at this stage. Two orders of magnitude, essentially, of the cells have died in the lung within the first 48 hours, 24 hours, actually, of after injection. So many of the cells in the lung environment are dying off before they can do anything. We're already down to 1% of the cells surviving. So built on top of that, the two to three orders of magnitude of ability to actually generate a growth, and we can start to see why that becomes a very significant detriment, a disadvantage in problem with actual growth. And I should say that in these models, virtually every cell here is a stem cell. So we're not talking about the issue of whether or not these cells can grow. We know they can grow. Every cell essentially has stem cell properties. So built on top of this kind of model then is the concept, and I really only want to show you one model down here. There's a whole range of different possibilities that people have proposed for how metastasis might develop and why it should be such a poor, inefficient process. But certainly in the concept here that we want to really talk about is the idea that maybe only a very small fraction of the cells in that tumor really have stem cells capabilities. Now, in those animal models, as I said, that I showed you, virtually every cell falls in this category. But in most human tumors, we might argue that that would not be the case, and certainly the literature would argue that this number can be down in a few percent. But I think, as John has pointed out, there's still a lot of uncertainties about the interpretation of much of the data and how much of how well one can actually identify such cells. So thinking then about the issue of circulating tumor cells, one of the questions that we might ask is how many such cells are truly stem cells? And there's actually not a lot of data in that area, but the proportion of cells, the number of circulating tumor cells, which I've indicated here as CTC, is actually quite low. So this is a very recent paper that was published about circulating tumor cells in breast cancer. Now, there are various techniques to do this. These people are using a sorting technique from blood involving somewhat similar to the flow sorting technologies that John was talking about. And what you can see is that the number of cells that they were able to recover there were about 160 breast cancers that they studied, somewhere between 3 and 300 circulating tumor cells per 7.5 ml of blood. I'm not quite sure why it's 7.5 ml, but I think that has something to do with the actual technology which is actually being used. But this seems to be the standard way of reporting the number of circulating tumor cells that you can detect. So this is clearly a very low number of cells. So what they did was they asked the question, how many of those cells actually expressed stem cell markers? And for breast cancer, there are a certain number of these CD proteins that John was talking to you about, which have been used as a marker for stem cells. And they looked at the proportion of these cells which actually were expressing the CD markers to try and ask the question, are there cells which seem to have these stem cell markers? And the data, the numbers that they came up with were that about 2 to 5% of these CTCs actually were also expressing the CSC, the cancer stem cell markers. So not only is that, again, we're seeing a relatively slow fraction of the cells which are stem cells. So this may also be a factor which affects the inefficiency of the process. So coming then to the issue of pre-metastatic niches, which is another issue. The concept of pre-metastatic niches, as I said, has been developed from experimental studies again, and the concept is that, as I said, is that certain tumors may in fact, by some mechanism, be able to precondition certain organs for stem cells for tumor cells, or presumably stem cells, to be able to establish a new growth. And this is just one model that has been proposed, and I'm sorry you can hardly see this is from a paper by Bidard et al. And published in 2008 as a for a possible strategy here. And the nice thing about this model is that it looks at various steps and suggests the concept that that what is happening here is that this the metastatic niche is actually being conditioned by waves of tumor cells which are being thrown into the circulation by the tumor, and so that over the course of time, as cells are being being thrown into the circulation, they may in fact be actually modifying the local environment in an organ which is susceptible to metastasis from this particular tumor, such that later cells, these are our waves of cells coming in here, the early wave and the second wave and a third wave. The concept is that as the early cells really go through this process, they can't grow themselves, but they can set up an environment which allows the later cells to actually establish a growth. So in this kind of concept, then, one can think of go back to our discussion about the issue of why it takes so long, if you like, for a tumor to actually throw off a successful metastasis, a cell which actually will seed and form a metastasis. We need, this model then would argue that we need multiple levels of multiple cells to pass through the system in order to set up a situation which would actually allow for a tumor cell to actually initiate a metastasis and actually allow that metastasis to develop into a growth. So you can think then of this concept, really, that this is a process which goes on over a period of time. Cells are being thrown off into the circulation, but it takes a long time before one such cell is actually able to find an environment which has been conditioned by these earlier cells to allow it to actually form a metastasis. Now, I emphasize this is just one model of how a pre-metastatic niche might be established. As far as I'm aware, there's no direct proof yet that this is the appropriate model, but it allows us to kind of think about how this might work in this kind of concept. So then, if we can't think about this in terms of how we might want to treat microscopic metastasis, what we know is, as I said, is that there's a wide heterogeneity in metastatic properties in tumors. Different tumors throw off cells and actually establish metastatic growth at different sizes. But if we assume that metastatic seeding is increasing with the size of the primary, if the cell is throwing cells off all the time, we might anticipate as the primary is growing, once that process has actually started, then it will continue. So if you think about what that means that over a course of time, while the primary is still in the patient, before it's been diagnosed, we should be throwing off metastasis, and so we'll have a range of sizes of metastasis in that patient. And if we assume that the individual metastases are all growing at a similar rate, we don't have to assume that they grow at the same rate as the primary, but if they're all growing at a similar rate, then what we would have is this widespread of metastatic sizes in the patient. We'd have some metastases that are relatively large, but some maybe that have only just been initiated, which are actually very small. So then the issue is, well, if that's the case, then when do we want to start treatment? If we start treatment after the initiation of metastasis, we've got to have a treatment which is effective against metastases of different sizes, because some are going to be large and some are going to be small. If we treat with chemotherapy, then maybe we'll be able to take out all the small metastases, but we maybe won't be able to take out the bigger metastasis. And what that means is that we condense the size range by doing that. And we'll come back to that issue in a minute as well. On the other hand, maybe if we can give radiation or something which is able to kill over a wider range of sizes, we can take out a larger fraction of the metastatic populations. And so, but if on the other hand we don't give the patient any kind of adjuvant therapy for metastasis, then what detection of an early metastasis probably will mean, the first metastasis we detect is probably there's a whole batch of metastases which are smaller coming along behind that, what we might call follow-up metastasis. So one of the important questions then, coming back to the point that I was making before about treatment of individual metastasis, if you detect a metastasis in a patient sometime after the treatment of the primary, the successful treatment of the primary, what does that mean? Does it mean that there's only one such metastasis in that patient, or does it mean that that is just the front edge of a wave of metastases which are sitting in the patient getting larger over time? And this concept was kind of modeled in this paper from Withers, with the idea here then that within a patient you might have metastases which have a fairly large number of cells. In their model they made the assumption that a tumor was detectable when you had 10 to the 9 cells. Now, 10 to the 9 cells is about a cubic centimeter of tumor, so this is about the size at which one would normally become detectable. But you would have metastases then where that were smaller than that, a little bit smaller, all the way across, to those that are only very small indeed. So if we're actually going to treat, and here's the concept, the illustration here is radiation, with a dose of radiation, what dose of radiation do you need to take out all these metastases? The big metastases with lots of cells are going to need large doses of radiation to take them out. The very small metastases are going to take quite small doses of radiation to take them out. So the overall kind of effective dose response might look like that if we have this big range of metastases. And that's making the assumption that you've got exponential growth of metastases. If you make the assumption that actually as the tumors get larger as they go, the metastases get larger as they grow, undergo a kind of what's called a Gompertzian type growth, where the growth rate slows down as they get larger, then you would actually convert that kind of curve into a curve like this, because what you're seeing, because of the fact that they're slowing down in growth when they get larger, you actually have got a predominance of tumors which tend to be a little bit larger because they're not growing so fast. So what that means is the efficiency of a low dose is actually less than it would be if you had this wide range. And this is data that they were able to actually get out of some work on irradiation for, in this case, lymphatic metastasis in rectal carcinoma over a range of sizes. And these patients were given very short radiation treatment schedules preoperatively, just prior to operation, in order to try and reduce the chance that they would develop lymphatic metastasis, and you can see, in fact, that this was the larger the dose of radiation you give, the more likely you are to do that, and that curve actually looks not too dissimilar to this curve. So, kind of argues that there's a consistency to that. If, of course, you don't do the treatment right about the same time that you're actually removing the primary, you actually delay the treatment for the metastasis at some point in time, then of course these metastases will grow, all of them will grow, but we won't be seeding any new ones because the primary is gone. So what that will mean is that you essentially shift that curve over like this, because more of the metastases are larger relative to, you don't see any small ones anymore. And of course this is always limited at this end to this size at which you can diagnose the metastasis. So the whole thing is limited at the top end in this kind of modeling. So then the question is, what can we get from this kind of thinking? Well, obviously one would argue that we know, as I said, that solitary metastasis can be treated, but the question is, how do we identify whether it's a solitary metastasis or whether it's first of many that are coming on behind? And this obviously depends on the time of seeding relative to the time of treatment. But it also depends a little bit on the time of detection relative to treatment, because if it's taken a long time after the primary treatment was treated, a primary tumor was treated, before you see metastasis, then what that tells you is that likely that metastasis was seeded very close to the time that you actually treated the primary. So it's taken a long time to grow up. That means probably that there's not a lot of these follower metastases coming behind it. So the longer it is between the time that you actually treat the primary successfully and you detect a metastasis, the more likely it is that that might be a single metastasis. But this also, of course, depends on the growth rate of the metastasis, as we've said. And it could also, and then we also have to consider this issue, as I said before, is whether if you've given adjuvant chemotherapy, you could actually have eliminated a batch of the smaller follower metastasis. And so even in a situation where you've given adjuvant therapy, but you still see these late, you see a late metastasis arising, you might argue, again, the likelihood is that we've taken out the follower metastasis, so this is more likely to be a single primary, and it might be worth the effort to really treat aggressively to try and get rid of that metastasis, because it's unlikely that, that there may be a lot more metastasis coming behind. So the issue is, can we kind of predict that using some kind of modeling strategy? Now, and the strategy that I was suggesting is a way to go there. But of course, there are many uncertainties. We in fact know that the heterogeneity in the growth, in the, there's a significant heterogeneity in the growth rate of metastasis, and that's illustrated on a little bit on this slide. This is, again, is an animal model, where we're actually looking at, in this case, the B16 mouse model, and we're looking at the number of lung metastases that you see, and the size of those metastases at a given time. And so what's happened here is we've injected cells into the tail vein of the mice. The cells have arrested in the lung. That's the first capillary bed they see. And then they've started to form metastasis. And then at this time point, day 22 after injection, we looked at the size of the metastasis. All those cells were put into the lung at the same time. They all had the same chance to form metastasis. But what we're seeing is that the range of sizes is a factor of 10. So there's quite, in fact, quite a difference in the growth rate of those metastases as they've grown up. So the concept that all metastases grow at the same rate is probably a little bit simplistic. So we also know that there's a lot of heterogeneity in actually seeding of metastasis, and also the number of metastases that you get may vary from one animal to another, and that's illustrated here. This is a situation where we're now looking at spontaneous metastasis. So we've got a primary tumor growing in the leg of the mouse in this particular case, and we're looking at the number of metastases in individual mice. All of these mice have tumors of this, which have grown up, and we see that some mice develop very large numbers of tumors in their lung, whereas some mice develop very few tumors in their lung, some none at all, in fact, as those tumors are growing. So again, this illustrates the point I was making before, that there's a big range of the spread. And similar type of experiment, this is a spontaneous animal model where the animal actually develops spontaneous breast cancer, and you see the number of metastases which are developing in those animals at a fixed primary size, again, is quite variable. And this is an experiment where we actually try to ask the question, well, what's this due to? Is it due to some feature of the environment that the cells are in? And what we did in this experiment was we actually injected into the animal two different cell populations which would form metastasis. This is the KHT cell and a B16 cell, which we've seen those cells before. These are highly metastatic cell populations. If you actually look at the number of metastases you get in the animals which are injected with the mixed population versus the number you get if you inject only the KHT cells, looking here only at KHT metastasis, you can do this because the B16 metastases are essentially forming melanin, so they look black, whereas these are white in the lung. You see that there's a very nice correlation, both for the KHT metastases and the B16 metastases in different animals when you do that injection. But if you actually look at the number of metastases, the B16 metastases now on the vertical axis versus the KHT metastases in this mixed population, there's absolutely no correlation. So these two cell populations are entirely different in terms of the way they respond in the different animals. There's something about the animals, the different animals, which are giving you different numbers of metastases, but it's entirely different between these two cell populations. So different cells apparently are responding differently in what should be the same environment. That's the lung environment of the mouse. And you can see exactly the same thing in this experiment. This is an experiment where we actually used labeled cells with fluorescent markers to do a very similar experiment, where we looked at cells which are labeled with green fluorescent protein or red fluorescent protein. And here we're looking at these are human cells now injected into SCID mice. So there's no immune system involved here. You see again, if you inject the same cell population, this is a human cervix cancer cell population. Here are the red cells and the green cells. There's actually quite a good correlation. It's actually not a one-to-one correlation, but the correlation is reasonably good. But if you look at the cervix cancer cells against now, this is a fibrosarcoma, human fibrosarcoma, absolutely no correlation between the two populations. So something about the cell population and the way it interacts with the environment is very different from one tumor to another. And so this makes things more difficult, of course, to understand what's going on. And we also know that the effect of the primary of the microenvironment of the tumor itself is also important. And as we talked about, there is this issue of the role of the metastatic niche and how important that is. So all of these factors make this kind of modeling more uncertain. But we're starting to know about these things, so we really have a chance to really maybe build these into a model. And I'll pass over that one really then to our conclusions then. Are that we know that metastasis causes many cancer deaths, and we also know that adjuvant prophylactic treatment may actually reduce or even prevent metastasis in some patients. But the issue is the toxicity that goes along with such treatments acceptable, and particularly not only in terms of patients who maybe we have a high probability will have metastasis, but also who may not have metastasis and therefore are being treated unnecessarily. So how do we deal with that problem, and can we use modeling to help us deal with that problem? And that's the real question. So can we really develop realistic models which will allow us to predict whether patients are likely to have metastasis, and whether, if we do detect a single metastatic lesion sometime after primary treatment, is it really a solitary lesion and we should treat it aggressively, or is it just the leading wave of a large wave of metastasis which really we'll have a great deal of difficulty dealing with. So the question is, how do we really do this kind of modeling? Thank you very much.